It is not surprising, I suppose, that the horrors of war give birth to a new generation of Good Samaritans, young men and women who have been so intensely exposed to such inhumanity, often make a silent pledge that if they ever escape this dark world of death and injuries, this universe of cruelty, they will devote their lives to good works. Sometimes the pledge is a conscious thought. Sometimes it is a subconscious reaction to their experiences. This is the story of a Good Samaritan who set out in life to heal, found his greatest personal and professional test under fire, and returned home to his original calling with a renewed sense of mission. There had never been a military operation remotely approaching the scale and the complexity of D-Day. It involved 176,000 troops, more than 12,000 airplanes, and almost 10,000 ships, boats, landing crafts, frigates, sloops, and other special combat vessels, all involved in a surprise attack on the heavily fortified north coast of France to secure a beachhead in the heart of enemy-held territory so that the march to Germany and victory could begin. It was daring, risky, confusing, bloody, and ultimately glorious. It will live forever as a stroke of military genius that even though it went awry and spilled ashore in chaos, it succeeded. It was so risky that before he launched the invasion, gambling that a small break in the weather would hold, General Dwight Eisenhower personally wrote out a statement taking full responsibility for the failure if it occurred. He was grateful he never had to release it. A new generation of Americans has a greater appreciation of what was involved on D-Day as a result of Steven Spielberg's stunning film, Saving Private Ryan. For most younger Americans, D-Day had been a page or two in their history books or some anniversary ceremony on television, with a lot of white-haired men leaning into the winds coming off the English Channel as President Reagan or President Clinton praised their contributions. Saving Private Ryan, a work of fiction, was true to the sound, the fury, the death, the terrible wounds of that day. Charles O. Van Gorder was a special part of D-Day. He was a 31-year-old captain in the U.S. Army Medical Corps in June 1944, a graduate of the University of Tennessee Medical School. He'd already served in North Africa when he volunteered to be part of a two-team surgical unit that would try something new for D-Day. It would be part of the 101st Airborne Assault Force, setting up medical facilities in the middle of the fighting instead of safely behind the lines. They knew that casualties would be high and that saving lives would require immediate attention. So Captain Van Gorder and his colleagues were loaded onto gliders for the flight across the English Channel and into Normandy. These were primitive aircraft made of tubing, canvas, and plywood, with no engines, of course. They had never been used for such daring maneuvers. They were silent, giving the element of surprise, and they could land in rough terrain. Van Gorder remembers, "We landed in the field where we were supposed to, but they forgot one thing. When they put the brakes on, it made that glider like an ice sled. It went zooming across the field. We hit a tree, which ended up right between the pilot and the co-pilot. Nobody in my glider was killed, but nearly all of the other gliders had someone killed or injured." That was at 4 a.m. By 9 the same day, June 6, 1944, Van Gorder and his fellow doctors had set up an operating facility, a precursor to the MASH units, the Mobile Army Surgical Hospitals, that saved so many lives and later on television gave us so much intelligent entertainment. They were located in a French chateau. They converted the milk storage room to an operating room, and by late that afternoon, the chateau grounds were covered with wounded young Americans, 300 or 400. Van Gorder and the other surgeons operated around the clock for 36 hours, always wearing their helmets because the chateau was often in the line of fire. The Army had issued the medical team several cases of Scotch whiskey, and Van Gorder later remembered, "The only thing that kept us going was sipping that Scotch. Finally, I got so tired, my head fell down into an open abdomen." He was ordered to go back to his tent for some rest. En route, a soldier suggested he go to the mess area for some hot chocolate. When he turned to go back for that refreshment, a German bomb hit his tent, demolishing it. It was the first of many narrow escapes for Dr. Van, as he was called. Altogether, it was a frantic and grisly scene that even now, more than 50 years later, Dr. Van Gorder cannot remove from his memory. "I have flashbacks every day," he says. "All those boys being slaughtered, sometimes 200 boys, and only 10 surgeons. The war made me a better doctor because I had to do all kinds of surgery. There were no trauma surgery books before the war to learn from." Van Gorder's D-Day ordeal was not the end of his frontline experience. It was only the beginning. His unit stayed with the 101st over the next 6 months as it fought its way across Europe, headed for the heart of Germany. They were in the thick of the fighting during the long siege in Belgium and during the Battle of the Bulge. In December 1944, Dr. Van Gorder and his colleague and friend, Dr. John Rada, were in the middle of surgery when their makeshift operating room came under heavy fire from German forces. "I was practically lying on my stomach operating on patients," Van Gorder remembers, "because of the shooting coming right into the tent. I was the only one who spoke German, so I went to the end of the tent and waved a towel through the flap. I told the German commander we had more than 50 wounded, including German POWs. He told me to load them up. I had to leave one patient behind with his stomach open." They were taken prisoner on December 19, 1944, Dr. Van Gorder's 32nd birthday. Van Gorder had suffered shrapnel wounds in his knees while the operating tent was under fire, so his friend Dr. Rada supported him as they trekked through the snow under the watchful German guns. Van Gorder is convinced that without Rada's help, the Germans would have shot him as a straggler. He returned the favor when Rada became ill. Two young American doctors, who had seen more death and suffering than most graduating classes of doctors were likely to see in a lifetime, were now trying to keep each other alive. Nothing in medical school had prepared them for this primal struggle of being prisoners of war in a bleak winter landscape in the heart of enemy territory. Back home, their families had no idea of what they were going through. And it was just as well. Van Gorder, Rada, and the other prisoners were packed into boxcars, and the train moved them to the north of Germany, where they stayed on a siding for 3 days, locked inside. Half of us would stand, and half of us would sit in rotation because it was so crowded, Van Gorder remembers. Van Gorder got out of the crowded quarters when the Germans needed a doctor to operate on a German soldier suffering from appendicitis. It was almost a fatal mission, however. American planes attacked the German train, not knowing there were Americans on board. Van Gorder ducked beneath a car to avoid the heavy fire and then told the Germans, "I'm going to let the others out." He risked his life to race into the line of fire and open the boxcar doors. The Americans poured out and immediately ran to a small hill and formed a human sign, U.S. POWs. The attacking American planes waggled their wings to indicate they understood and broke off the attack. The German army was fighting a losing battle, retreating deeper and deeper to the east, taking their prisoners with them. Van Gorder and Rada were taken first to Poland and then to the Russian border. In the confusion, they escaped and started making their way back west through Poland. Whenever they came upon a Polish hospital, they'd stop to do what they could for the patients there, as most of the Polish doctors had been conscripted by the Germans. Finally, they made their way back to the American lines in the spring of 1945. Their war was over. "When I was finally discharged, I had served 5 years in the war. I was overseas for 30 months straight," Dr. Van Gorder says, without a trace of bitterness. During that time, his wife Helen, a nurse from Nova Scotia he'd met in New Jersey during his medical residency before the war, gave birth to their first son, Rod. The infant died shortly after birth, a victim of sudden infant death syndrome. Dr. Van Gorder was in North Africa at the time, a long way from his wife's side.